Well, it's Wednesday, the 23rd of July, 2025, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, reflecting on some of the construction news headlines from the past couple of weeks. And actually, today, we're looking back at events going back over the past decade with a special guest who I'll introduce in a few minutes' time. But first, I suppose we ought to mention some of the big stories which have broken over the past week or so. And I suppose there's one which stands out, Phil. Which one do you think that would be?
Yes, hello. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Phil.
I think the big story of the week is Sizewell C. It's about the 12th time it's got the green light. Every time everything happens, it's got the green light.
Yes.
I use the word green light in my headline. I probably shouldn't have. This is sort of the green light in as much as the most important thing, the money, has been agreed. Yeah. But the main contracting team, which has just been picked because they're doing Hinkley Point C of Bruges, Langer O'Rourke and Balfour Beatty, they have not been given a start date yet. There's lots of earth moving going on and preliminary works and access roads and all that sort of stuff. Utility diversion, I guess. I don't know how much utility diversion is involved. But there's lots of work going on in the area. But actual main construction has not yet started, and there is no start date for that, nor is there an end date. Whether that depends on progress on at Hinkley Point, I don't know. I guess it does. However, the fact that they've sorted out the shareholders and what's being funded by money going in and debt guarantees and so on and so forth is all very, very good news as far as the construction industry is concerned. Not such good news for the poor people of Suffolk who don't want to this huge, great £40 billion construction project on their doorstep. But the nation needs it.
Yes, indeed. And we're going to start paying for it before they've throughout the entire process of building it, aren't we? It's not as if we're going to say they're going to deliver the project and we're going to say thanks very much and pay for it then. We're paying for it now, aren't we?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I know that the concept is this regulated asset base funding model that we've talked about, which they used for Thames Tideway. The Thames Tideway, it was clear, it was a Thames Water project, and Thames Water customers have been paying a little bit extra, quite a lot extra, I don't know how many pounds extra on their bills for years and years and years, all through the, during the construction of this project. So it was kind of lots and lots of people paying a little bit for a long period of time to make it
softens the blow a bit.
Yes, exactly. What I don't know, my energy provider is I can't remember the name of it, but the one that Which and Martin Lewis and everyone guarantees now
Octopus.
So Octopus has got nothing to do with it. So whether I'm going to have to pay extra on my bills, whether it's sort of a government tax, if you like, on all electricity bills, or if it's only people who have their bills from, I don't know, but basically,
exactly. I don't know.
Consumers are going to pay a little tax on there, a little extra on their bills, but I don't know the mechanics of that.
I mean, the way that what's his name? Ed Miliband, the energy secretary, he sort of set out how it's going to be funded. And we did talk about this a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? Because EDF has reduced its stake in Sizewell C, probably because it's had its fingers burned on Hinkley Point C and it doesn't want to be so exposed when it comes onto this project.
But its whole arm's burnt, I think.
Well, yeah, exactly. So the biggest shareholder is going to be the UK government, or rather the taxpayer. So we've got a 44.9% stake in Sizewell
C
now.
Yes, it's minority. I don't know. Sometimes in these things, it's organised so that you might not have a majority stake, but you've got a majority voting. Your voice counts for more than your money, if you know what I mean. I don't know whether they've tied that into the deal, or whether all the private investors can, at any board meetings, can vote down Keir Starmer or Ed Miliband or whoever happens to be representing the taxpayers at these meetings. I mean, I think it's unlikely, but there's a large hint that these are starting position and that, you know, yes, things are subject to change.
Well, that seems to be, that's always the case with big infrastructure projects. You set out the best, you know, sort of a best case scenario, really. This is what it's going to cost. And then you adjust it as things start to solidify, as it were, or as the waters get even more muddied. But I mean, one of the big, the sort of fanfare when they made this announcement last week was that they've actually decided how much it's going to cost, because, you know, obviously people are worried about cost overruns on a big project like this, and they are, as I said, virtually inevitable, although not necessarily so. But they say it's going to cost £38 billion to build Sizewell C now, which is great because that's a lot less than what it's cost to build Hinkley Point. But, you know, they overlooked, or they didn't sort not to mention the fact that originally they said it's going to be £20 billion to build Sizewell C.
And as I understand it, that £20 billion, they said not terribly many years ago, included, and that was the whole project cost.
Okay. Yes, that's right.
Whereas this £38 billion is construction cost. Okay, construction is the vast majority of it all, but there's still, I mean, you think of all the legal challenges that there have been to this.
Yeah.
A lot of expensive lawyers have been involved, a degree of land acquisition and so on and so forth. So there are costs aside from construction.
So yeah. I think the cost estimate, the £38 billion, isn't at current or forecast prices. That's at 2015 prices?
No, 2024. Like
the 2024 prices, all right.
Sort then. Of current.
Not so bad.
Not exactly.
Okay. They've made great play of the fact, and we've mentioned it ourselves in the past, that because they've got the same construction team, essentially, moving directly from Hinkley Point C to Sizewell C, and the fact that, of course, Sizewell C is a sort of carbon copy of Hinkley Point, there's going to be huge efficiencies, you know, lessons learned and all the rest of it. They know how much concrete they're going to need. They know how much steel they're going to need. They'll know how long it takes to do this bit or that bit. So there should be plenty of savings there. But I think they said a 20% saving on Hinkley Point cost, something like that. It's not as much as I was expecting.
They reckon 20%. But what I find curious that no one's raised a question about, because it does absolutely make sense that the people building Hinkley Point C should build Sizewell C. I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But there used to be rules that public contracts had to go out to tender. Now, whether this is a Brexit dividend, that we don't have to tender public contracts, and you just give them to whoever you think's best for the job.
Mm.
But it does open up a can of worms. If any you know, Secretary of State or union official, let's say, decides just to give contracts to their mates because they think they're the best person for the job without market testing.
Mm. Yes.
The precedent's been set.
Yes, I mean, you're referring to EU regulations about public sector contracts there, weren't you? We're no longer bound by those, presumably. But don't we have something?
But I think there's still UK
to replace it.
Yeah, the whole I can't remember what the local government legislation was, but when compulsory competitive tendering was introduced for street cleaning and emptying bins and pothole filling for local authorities.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there was some sort of equivalent UK law. But maybe it was, you know, when that was turned into, became part of a bigger EU law, and when the EU law was abolished or written, you know, struck off the books or whatever as part of the whole post-Brexit legislation, maybe that's no longer the case. Maybe big contracts can just be handed out.
Well, I mean, we don't build nuclear power stations on a regular basis. All right, then we've had two back to back, but presumably these are special cases. I mean, they're one offs.
No,
actually, you can't even say they're one offs because Sizewell C isn't a one off.
No, I mean, I get that it's sensible. I'm just interested about the implications. Maybe I'm missing something, and a framework was announced, and there's the framework, and these three companies are the only people on the framework, which was set up some time ago, and they're simply being called off. They've pre-qualified, and now they're being called off this framework, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, it does make sense, as you said, to draw on the lessons learned by the people building Hinkley Point C, because, you know, they've made a few mistakes perhaps, and hopefully they won't make the same mistakes again. So it does make sense from the from the taxpayers' point of view, apart from anything else, that hopefully people will do it right this time.
Unless all the brightest and best brains from those three companies who are leading Hinkley Point C, you know, decided to set up their own new company to as a startup to build nuclear power stations, and then they come and think, oh, hang on, you know, we've left with these three companies, but all the best people have gone and set up their own thing.
Interesting. I doubt that's happened. Let's hope it hasn't anyway. So we're just waiting for what, spades in the ground next. That's the next thing, presumably.
Yes. I did ask, I got some, bosses of Lange O'Rourke and Balfour Beatty, Leo Quinn and Cathal O'Rourke sent out very anodyne statements. You know, we welcome this, we look forward to, and, you know, rah, rah. And so I replied to one of them saying, this is, you know, thank you for sending me this, but it doesn't actually give us any new information. Do you have any heads up of when you might actually be starting work and when you expect to finish it? And I said, we have nothing to add at this stage. Suggesting that they have no idea when they're starting work.
No, quite. Well, there's a very vocal anti-Sizewell C organisation. Who's the woman who...
Alison Downes. She gets an awful lot of coverage for herself. She seems like a very smart, organised woman.
She is, yeah. So, I mean, I don't know how many other people are objecting to it. I mean, presumably those local people who don't want the project to go ahead, they're just behind Alison Downes, but there must be others. I don't know, Greenpeace, people like that, the Anti-Nuclear Alliance, if there is such a thing. But I don't know whether or not there's sort of a wider opposition to the project or whether it's just a local one.
Well, there are people who... the anti-nuclear power lobby has gone particularly quiet because they realise it's that or fossil fuel, basically, at the end of the day. Yeah. I mean, yes, you know, wind and solar are great, but if you've got any brain about you, if you dig into it, we need nuclear.
Yeah, for your base load.
So I think it is essentially the most vigorous opposition is local. And I've been to Southwold, which is just north of the power station, a couple of times in the past few years, and you visit the neighbouring village of, I mean, Southwold's full of people passing through, but the neighbouring village of Warbiswick, which is beautiful, it's where all the celebrities live, like Richard Curtis and Emma Freud's wife, and Simon Mayo, and the various others, or at least they have their, you know, they live in London, have their weekend houses there. That village is plastered in, you know, no to Sizewell C posters, and there's a lot of opposition, a lot of, you know, well, placarding there.
Only to be expected, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't accuse any of those people of being NIMBYs. I mean, because if somebody was to say we're going to build a nuclear power station in Ilfracombe, I'd probably have something to say about it.
I don't understand why NIMBY is so pejorative. I mean, why wouldn't you be? I mean, everyone's a NIMBY, and if you're not a NIMBY, you're
That's
stupid.
True. Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I'd agree with you there. So have we got any other stories to wrap up before we introduce our guest?
Yeah, well, the other big, long-awaited announcement event that happened last week was the publication, in inverted commas, of the infrastructure pipeline, which everyone's been saying. The government produced its... we talked, I think, last month about the infrastructure strategy that the government published, and I couldn't get excited by it. I thought, yes, it's better than not having it, but it didn't kind of tell us anything we didn't know. And everyone was saying, yeah, this is great, but what we really need is the infrastructure pipeline, the list of, the plan. This is what we're going to build. And it's come out, the infrastructure pipeline. You can find it at pipeline.nista.grid.civilservice.gov.uk. Mm-hmm. Nice and catchy. Why don't put it at infrastructurepipeline.com? I don't know. But anyway, whereas before, when these lists of projects have been published. They've been producing a sort of a white paper as a document, or you get it online as PDF or whatever. But this devised as the appearance of a sort of a spreadsheet, Excel spreadsheet, but an online. And the idea is going to be dynamic in the sense that it's subject to continual revision. So when more information comes in, when projects move forward, when projects get scrapped, when new ones emerge, you can add to it, remove, whatever. Which sounds great, except they're not going to do anything to it until the next revision is January. So it's only be twice yearly revisions, which is better than once every 5 years or whatever. Dynamic suggests that it's, as it happens, it's going to be changing, but it's not entirely the case. What struck me was how many gaps there are in its first iteration. Now, it is its first iteration, and NISTA, this new organisation, the National Infrastructure and Service Transformation Authority, very keen to show that it's doing something. We're up and running, and here's the pipeline up and running, which is, which is great. The sooner it gets up and running, the better. But in its current form, what strikes me are more the, what it doesn't say than what it does say, frankly.
What's missing? I mean, what sort of gaps are there then?
It includes, I'm just going to click on it and open it up and talk about it that way, pipeline.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it lists 775 projects, and it says over the next 10 years, 531 billion. But actually, it's more than 531 billion because an awful lot of these 775 projects don't have a cost attached to them.
Okay.
We don't know what they are. A lot of the energy projects, for example, aren't government projects. They're private sector, but they're subject to government control in a sense, in as much as the government, I can't remember the jargon, but it's subject to government regulation because the government sort of give licenses or says, right, if you put up that wind farm, you can do that and you can you'll get that amount of money for your electricity kind of thing. So a lot of energy, solar and wind projects are on there, but they've got no costs associated with them. Right, I'm looking up all these transport projects. And, for example, there's a project called A38 Derby Junctions in the East Midlands, transport, subsector roads, CapEx. It doesn't say how much it's going to cost. It doesn't say when money's going to be spent. In what years? It doesn't say what stage the project's at. Can I bid for this project? It doesn't even say, National Highways linked. I would like to have a link to the National Highways project page of it, which would be, for that in itself,
that would make sense.
There's an awful lot of work to do to improve it. But if you could link on a project and go get further information about that project and find that, it's out for tender, I can bid now. Or it's expected to go out for tender in 2 years' time or whatever. So this is not aimed at me. I'm just a journalist looking for information. But if I was a contractor looking to know to bid for it, I think I would also be a little bit frustrated by it. But a bit meh. How does this help me?
Yeah.
Okay. There's all these great projects.
So what is the benefit of it? Is there any benefit?
Well, if all the quotes you get from the trade associations and the big construction welcoming it, saying this is great, it gives reassurance to investors, it gives us reassurance and our shareholders. What it means essentially is that your Balfour Beattys and Morgan Sindals of the world can go to shareholders and city meetings and say, we're in this business. And have you seen how much bloody money is going to be spent in this business?
Yeah.
There's going to be 587 billion spent over the next 10 years. And we at the moment have roughly, let's say 5% of this market.
Okay.
So we know we're going to get 10 billion pounds. So they can use it to say, buy our shares because this is the market we're in. So it's just a bargaining chip as far as I can see.
Mm.
Good, nice, useful one. but I don't really think that anyone further down the supply chain, I don't think, Roger Bullivant is going to look at this list and say, we need to buy another piling rig. The pipeline's been published.
Yeah, I suppose until contracts are actually awarded, certainly a subcontractor like Bullivant wouldn't invest on the strength of that, would they?
I think they would wait till they were, had a a visible tender list that they're on, expecting to, you know, if they, I don't know what the strike rate would be for your average piling contractor, one in five, one in three, I don't know. But if they had more work that they had the equipment for, then they go out, you know, the, or
in, go out and buy some more rigs.
They go out and buy, or, you know, get it on HP and buy it when they've got, they've actually won the contract or whatever. But the, I mean, the pipeline, it's sort of significant, but I'm looking forward to it to getting an awful lot better, because it could be really good.
Well, I think that's enough of the last week's news, Phil. And as I said, we have a guest joining us today. So let's introduce her. Susanna Nicol is Chief Executive of Build UK, the body set up to represent the UK construction supply chain, and which is celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. So happy birthday, Build UK. Welcome to Reconstruction, Susanna, and happy anniversary, happy birthday, whatever. Does it feel like 10 years?
Thank you for all of the congratulations there, David, and a nice warm welcome. Oh, sometimes it feels like it was yesterday that we were creating it, and sometimes it feels like there was never not a Build UK. So I think it depends on what I'm doing and what day it is as to how long it's been. But it's been a great 10 years.
Yeah. Well, Build UK, I mean, I'm sure most of our listeners know what Build UK is, but maybe not all of them know about how it came about, because it was a merger of two existing organisations, one which was the National, I think it's the National Specialist Contractors Council. That was your, that was your baby, wasn't it? You were leader of that at the time. And then there was the UK Contractors Group, which represented main contractors, tier one contractors. And I can remember there was a lot of, I was going to say controversy, there was a lot of discussion at the time about whether or not you could have a single body representing both main contractors and their sort of extended supply chain, the specialist contractors, because one of the major concerns of the specialist contractors was sort of payment abuse by their customers, the main contractors. But it, it seems to have settled in quite well. I mean, there doesn't seem to have been any conflict.
I'm going to interrupt and say, quite frankly,
go on then.
10 years ago, I thought, I didn't give it a cat in hell's chance of that unholy alliance sticking together for 10 years. I mean, these were the two polar opposites of the industry. You know, how on earth can one organisation, you know, represent Andrew Cleese and the line? That's a bad analogy. But, you know, I just figured it was, your job must have been like taking a fox, a chicken and a bag of corn across the river. And, you know, how do you stop them from meeting each other? But you're still here. So talk us through the discussions. I mean, how did it come about?
I'm stuck on the fox, the chicken, and the
corn. Me too.
I like a challenge. People that will know me will like a challenge. And one of my kind of personal mantras to most things is there is always a way. You've just got to find it. And I like to think that's what we're good at. So to roll back, probably about 11 years from where we are now, where we were sitting around government tables with a whole array of trade bodies representing construction. And if you remember, we had ministers were like through a revolving door, and we've had a little bit more stability over the last few years. But it was it's a revolving door of ministers. You know, I've got a list up on my board, and it's something like over 26 years we've had 26 construction ministers. And so the industry would troop in, and we would share our pain in front of a relatively new minister. There'd probably be a few dust-ups between the trade bodies, and the minister would literally sit back with their hands behind their head, wait until the industry had done all its stuff, and then they would make the decision. And I remember sitting there thinking, this is so wrong. This industry is huge. It is dynamic. It has so much to offer, and it actually has a lot of the answers. We should be the ones driving what happens within the industry and making the decisions, not a government minister, particularly not one who has literally found themselves in the seat that day. And the opportunity arose from the organisation that I ran. And David, the fact that you have to kind of dig deep and remember the names, I think is a good sign. We've achieved that shift. There was an opportunity. The organisation that I rose, we had become larger as a specialist sector. We had a really, really strong voice. When I took it over, I think it was about 24, 5 years ago, it was a relatively small organisation with not much strategy apart from the passion of the whole supply chain of specialist contractors. But we'd grown that. We'd grown a really clear, strong voice. We're really clear on our policies. You're absolutely right. Payment was key, because ultimately, if cash isn't flowing through the supply chain or through businesses, then there isn't really much else. They cannot survive. They cannot thrive. And we need that for the industry. At the same time, there was an opportunity with the tier one contractors where their chief executive was retiring. So I had a conversation between my chairman, who was a chap called Kevin Louch, a concrete flooring specialist, and James Waits, now obviously Sir James Waits, about how we could be so much smarter. And we really should be sitting around the same table with a contracting supply chain, the core of it. Ultimately, whilst we have differences, we have much more in common. We ultimately all want the same game. And when you speak to people, the same goal, and when you speak to people in construction, they're really passionate generally about delivering a really good built environment, more better infrastructure that is well maintained. They want to run good, safe businesses which look after their people, and they want to turn a bit of profit at the end of the day. So we had much more in common. And even on the issues of payment, when you started to discuss it, actually, again, we wanted the same thing. So it was a matter about how we could achieve that. And the first proposal was, we can do that so much better sitting around the same table. And then we go to government and ask it to pull levers. And I'll be completely honest, you know, a bit like you, Philip, there were people who were, you know, arms folded, said, it'll never work. You'll never do it. But both Kevin and James looked at me and said, do you think we can do this? And I said, well, do you know what? We're going to give it our best shot. And actually, things came together much quicker than I think anybody thought, because once you talk about sitting around the same table, having the conversations, some of which are then not public. And I always said my job might just be to pour the water and get the right people around the table, provide the tea, provide the coffee, chuck in a few questions. You know, there might be some quite spicy conversations.
Yeah.
Actually, once you started to get people round the table, the conversation just shifted up a gear and people really wanted to talk. So we looked at some quick wins, and we can come on to those. And we looked at, I was quite upfront that payment was going to be an issue we were going to talk about. We weren't going to hide from it. You know, there might be blood on the table, but we were going to push through it, and we were going to do it with the industry in charge, not external stakeholders telling us what we should do.
Was there not a problem with a sort of a power imbalance to begin with, where you've got, you know, these big tier one contractors, very powerful companies with, you know, huge resources, and then, you know, a myriad small contractors? I mean, how did it work out? And how could the small contractors compete on equal terms or operate on equal terms with the tier one contractors under the sort of Build UK umbrella?
I'm going to guess, because Susanna came from their side and was on, and your instincts, I bet, were on the side of the small contractors. You've obviously had to temper that over the years, but I'm sure that was your starting point. You couldn't help it.
I like to think it's because I've got all-round experience. So I started my career as a site engineer. I qualified as a health and safety professional. I'd worked for a mid-range contractor. I'd worked for a major contractor. And then you're right, I spent a huge amount of time working for the specialist contractors. So I'd seen it from kind of lots of different angles, which is part of the strength of Build UK. We spend a lot of time doing that 360 degrees. What will they think? What will they think? What's your view? How does it work from you? That way you get under the skin of it and understand it. But I actually think, Philip, part of it is because I can sit in the middle as an honest broker, and my whole team can sit in the middle as an honest broker. You know, what is the right answer? What is actually happening in reality? Don't forget also, the specialist contracting supply chain makes up the majority of a contractor's business. A tier one contractor can do nothing without its specialist contractors. So there was a win for everybody. And Sir Michael Latham always said that. I think he quoted from Alice in Wonderland, everyone must have prizes. You know, everyone's got to win in this. It's not a win-lose game. We also had, don't forget, so contractors sit in Build UK in their own right as a business. As specialist contractors, and there was about 12,000 of them, sit under their trade bodies, who in their own right are incredibly strong. And I'm absolutely, you know, sometimes you think you wouldn't start from here with the way the industry's set up, but I'm an absolute passionate advocate for the weight of the trade bodies and them being absolutely cracking and all over their stuff in their specialist sector. So we had joint chairs to start with. We literally brought two boards together. So we had a kind of transition board, which brought together the board, the two boards from both organisations, and we made sure it was fair and equally split, and they were all good people. So they were on board. They didn't come with their arms folded. They came with their sleeves rolled up. How can we do this? So we had joint chairs and they were in place for 2 years. So I had Sir James and Kevin, who were both kind of architects alongside me and my colleague here, Joe, of how we moved forward. And they got on well together and both saw each other's point of view. We still to this day have a board that is 50-50. It's not quite, because we've now got a client co-opted on at the moment. But the board is 50-50, specialists nominated by specialists and nominated by contractors. And our chair's alternate. So we have 2 years of a Tier 1 contractor chair supported by a vice chair of a specialist. And then 2 years of a specialist chair supported by a Tier 1 contractor. So everybody's in it together. And that does seem to have worked so far.
But there is still that distinction. I mean, I suppose it's inevitable, but I suppose your ideal, I would hope, is that we lose the distinction between, you know, Tier 1 and subcontractors in terms of status. Because there are, I mean, there are some contractors who sort of fit into both camps. I mean, like, I'm thinking of, I don't know, Keltbray or someone. A lot of you know, large specialists who are sometimes Tier 1 and sometimes, and while some companies, well, even the big companies have got specialists as subsidiaries, a Vinci subsidiary might work for Morgan Sindall or something and doing the piling, or I guess. So the actual distinction in real life is a bit blurred, but in your organisation, it's still very much there, you're saying.
Whilst we categorise our members, because we do that for subscription purposes, for certain bits of legislation only apply on certain companies over a certain size. We do have some very large specialists in membership, which then sit under our contractor umbrella. And I think we also have to recognise that companies in that play different roles have different risk profiles and different responsibilities. So you're right, you named Keltbray there and Brendan was our chair for a couple of years during COVID. So sometimes they will operate as a Tier 1 and have that role and responsibility, and at other times they will be a specialist, and we've got others in the same boat. I actually believe that we should value and recognise what everybody's got in common, but also what makes them specialist. So the specialist contractors are really proud and passionate about the fact that they are specialists in their particular sector, in what they do. And some of them get very, very niche in what they do. Some of them are bigger specialists and cover a broad range. It's about celebrating and capitalising on the difference rather than making it an issue. And we try with all our meetings, whether it's a CEO lunch, whether it's a forum, whether it's a massive meeting on building safety, to bring the right blend of both people and organisations round the table. So it's almost, whatever question we've got, you've got somebody in the room who is now, as a result of the way we've operated, so confident at putting their hand up and saying, I can help on this. And the bigger, stronger companies will listen with respect because we've all learned the value of the supply chain. And let's not forget, we've now got clients, developers, professional services and others in membership.
Yeah.
So whilst we started with what we call that contracting core, those that deliver out on site, that do the physical building work, once we brought everybody together, we had clients literally knocking on our door saying, how do we get to be part of this? We want to be talking to the supply chain collectively. We don't want to be dividing and conquering. We are all in it together. Professional services then came. So we've got consultants, we've got those that support, and we've got institutions in membership as well, because they recognise the value of the industry being more collaborative, more joined up and solving its own challenges, not either asking others to or waiting for somebody else to resolve them.
Well, that's interesting. You mentioned Sir Michael Latham a little while back, and of course he famously published that report. Constructing the team? Was that him?
That's right.
That was in, what, 1995, 96, something like that.
I think it was 94, but...
Well, it was a long time ago.
The early 90s.
It was a long time ago. And in a way, Build UK is a sort of... The sort of embodiment of a lot of what he was recommending at the time, you know, this teamwork and the end of payment abuse and that kind of thing. Why do you think it took so long for something like Build UK to come about when Latham had already set out, you know, the groundwork for such a body so much, you know, a decade earlier?
We are a huge, huge industry. 1 in 10 of the working population works in construction. We're between 7 and 10% of GDP, depending on what stats you're looking at. And we are composed of about 3 million people, all with their own views, their own ways of looking at the world and how they want to do things. So change isn't easy. Change isn't easy for anybody. And when you have a lot of different industry bodies, clearly there's also vested interest. People like their particular grouping, they want to be there for a reason. And you still see it today, you know, groups pop up here, there and everywhere around a particular topic. I think I'm much more passionate at saying we're all in the same team. Actually, within that team, you then actually might want to look at things in a little bit more detail. It's about people playing to their strengths. So I can't really answer why it took so long. Once we saw the opportunity, we took it and made it happen. But I've always been a bit of a super fan of Sir Michael Latham. And I'll tell you why. When I was a very young spot in the industry, Sir Michael was the chair of CITB. He was the chairman of CITB. And I came across him a visit or a meeting or something. And he was incredibly kind. He took an interest and he took me under his wing. I think I probably asked a really awkward question when everybody else just sat and listened. He became one of those people who I called a part of my career journey. And we all need those and we should all be those. And so from the very first time I met him, and clearly he was incredibly senior within the industry, and I must have been about 21, and he reached out and gave me that little bit of support. And I have never, ever forgotten that. So when you find somebody like that who then talks your language, even on things that I probably didn't understand back when I was 21, it makes me incredibly proud that you've now kind of at this stage actually can see that link between all the things that he said and what we are doing as Build UK. So thank you.
No, not at all. So what do you think, what achievements of Build UK make you most proud? What are you most proud of having done in the past 10 years?
Maybe start at the beginning. So you mentioned the early wins, and they must have been significant particularly, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, significant but really small. One of the first things I wanted to demonstrate was that we were all in this together, that actually when you unravel all the problems that people bring to the table, when you kind of pick through them, they're actually the same issues. People are just looking at them from different ends of the supply chain, different end of the spectrum. But ultimately, it's how do you find a way that everybody moves forward, everybody wins? If you implement something that only that's very much one end of the spectrum to the other, then everybody fights against it and you can't do it. So it's finding that way. We see it in society, don't you? You kind of work out what moves everybody forward. So the very first thing we did was agreeing a standard for the colour of safety helmets, which... You see, it's just made you both laugh. I'm looking at you on screen. And I tell you why. We'd got all the issues kicking around in the industry. You know, we were constant recession, not recession, boom, bust, all of that. And one of the Tier 1 contractors said, oh, well, if only you could agree the colour of safety helmets, that would be worth it. And I went, what? Out of everything, that? And I thought, do you know what? Actually, that would be really easy. And if you remember, you'd look across London sites and everybody had a wide range of safety helmets on. So you didn't really know. We don't wear a uniform, so you don't really know who works for who, what their role is on site. And also, I was also a qualified health and safety professional for a fair few years as part of my career. The instruction in every briefing is tell your supervisor. And you'd look around a site and you wouldn't be able to tell who a supervisor was. So we pulled together the T1 contractors, and they'd been trying to do this for 3 years, which I hadn't realised. And I very simply kind of mapped out what they all did. And when you did that, I went, well, it's like the 80-20 rule. 80% of you are doing the same thing. Hmm. And when you set it out, they all went, all right, okay, we can do that. Well, we're not going to do it on our existing sites. That's fine. Do it on every new site. It reduces waste because you're not chucking away helmets. It starts to give people a sense of belonging because they know where they are. And we ended up with the safety helmet colour standing, where you've got white helmets for competence, because it was all about that journey of competence. You've got blue helmets if you're a newbie or vulnerable on site, you're an apprentice, you're a visitor, you know, you're, it's not your usual workplace. You've got the black hats, and then you have the orange hats if you are a slinger signaller. And majority of people said, we can do that. A couple went, well, we're not going to do it. I said, fine, I'll go with 80%. That sounds like a big step forward for me. But slowly but surely, everybody went, actually, we can understand this. Blue hats want to be a white hat. White hats want to be a black hat. Two of my proudest moments was when National Highways or England Highways, whatever it was then, actually phoned me up and said, can we adopt your policy? Oh, yeah. Yes, it's not my policy. It's become an industry standard. Mm. And the other one where my specialist contractor said, this is brilliant. We now get invited to black hat briefings, for the supervisor briefings. And that's when you think, oh, my goodness, something really small that everybody smiles at when you say, actually just demonstrated to everybody, if we can do it on something like this quite painlessly, we can do some big stuff together. Mm. So that's a long story for a very small part, but that then segued into things like the common assessment standard. We benchmark payment performance, and we have shifted the dial on payment forms. I'm always looking at, what do we do to shift the dial? We don't write reports, because in the nicest possible way, we're an industry that doesn't read them. Mm. That I've got a stack of reports in my office that are taller than me. Even I don't get past about page 30. I can see by my highlighting, my corners turning down, page 30, I think, is probably a train journey for me. I'm then done on to the next thing. And I'm a reader. A lot of our industry don't. They're out and about on site. They're on to the next thing. They're working off their mobile phones. So we don't write reports. We look at what needs shifting the dial for the whole supply chain. So improving payment performance. And we benchmark it on our website. So you can go in and see the payment terms of the top 100 businesses and all of our contractor members that have a duty to report their payment terms. We have increased over the first, I think it was the first 5 years of reporting, we improved the payment terms from 45 days average amongst our members down to 29 days just by benchmarking them. So we try and look at doing things differently as well. We don't do a report and expect people to do it. We navigated COVID. And you ask, that is probably out of all of it, that is the bit that massively floats to the top. We did the site operating procedures, my little team. Mm. We published them through the Construction Leadership Council, because we said, this is not just about our members. This is the whole industry. My heart actually races faster when I talk about COVID because of what we went through as an industry. Apart from the blue light and the food sector, we were the only industry that kept going through every single lockdown. We had weekly calls of our members. We had broadcast calls across the whole industry through the Construction Leadership Council. And I take my hat off to every single person who left their home when everybody was told to stay in, otherwise you will die. And they went out to work on a construction project of some kind, and they kept the industry moving. They kept the lights on across the country, and they did what they were asked, which was comply with some pretty strict and weird rules on site operating procedures. Mm. Over a weekend, we changed the opening hours of every single site in London. Otherwise, the mayor was going to shut us down. On a Friday, we called everybody in, literally a big broadcast call. Over the weekend, we sorted out where all the pinch points were, and every single site changed their opening hours, and every single person complied with what they're asked to do.
Can I?
Wow.
That just blows me away.
Can you tell me a bit more about the mechanics of formulating those rules, because they did emerge quite quickly. Obviously, you've got a health and safety background, as you say, so that must have helped. I suspect, I don't know how much your medical knowledge you have. So much of COVID, and there've been these, the inquiry following only in the newspapers. It's like, well, why did we do that? Well, we didn't know any better, so we, you know, it's belt and braces. We just sort of, there must. where are you getting your information from, and how are you deciding how it might be applied? Because a lot of it's, you know, it's stabbing in the dark, isn't it?
I have very limited medical knowledge. I think I did my first aid in the guides, apart from that. And I'm a mum, so I've bandaged knees and that's about it. It's a really interesting question. I was actually out in the States sailing with my parents in about the February of 2020. And I was sitting with my dad. We were literally watching the world close down, and they lived in America on this boat for 6 months of the year. So I'd kind of got the watching the world all start to happen. We were kind of obviously the three of us on a boat for 24 hours watching it all happen, chatting about it. And obviously they were in America, not at home. So it was starting to, are there going to be implications for them? We also had one of the Build UK's initiatives, which is Open Doors, where we open sites across the country. We'll come on to that later. And that was coming up in March. And I was watching this going, oh my goodness, this is going to affect us in lots of ways. So we did a couple of things. I knew we'd have to make a decision on Open Doors pretty quickly, but I also knew that our contractor members would be doing something. Okay, they're pretty smart cookies. And again, my role is, we very rarely start with a blank sheet of paper or reinvent the wheel. We don't have all the ideas. There were other people having great ideas. Our job is to bring them together and turn them into something everybody could do. So we asked a couple of our members, what were they doing? So they sent in their kind of latest site rules. And they were broadly, it was when the 2 metre rule was coming in and washing your hands. There was a whole debate about face coverings that actually, I'll be under my desk. We can cover that. That was horrendous. So we looked at what they did and we went, right, okay, we've got the bones of everybody's doing something, slightly different wording. We can do something here. We can pull it all together. Picked up what else everybody else was saying. You're right, Philip. There was no blueprint or toolkit for this. Things were changing on a daily basis. But we're pretty good at pulling out things, what people will need to do. So we set out our first draft of the site operating procedures. They will never be my finest work in terms of kind of, they were pulled together. We set them out, tidied them all up, so that if you remember, when they started making regulations, and we all sat in front of the TV watching Boris Johnson, didn't we? He held up two lists of industries that had to close by law. I can't believe 5 years later we're actually saying this. You had to close, or industries that were going to stay open. And construction wasn't on either of them. I think it was probably because it was in the two difficult ones. Construction wasn't on either of those two lists.
I don't remember that. That's amazing.
No, I don't remember that.
This is imprinted on my list. So we sat there and we actually had a call. This was before Zoom. Couldn't see any of them. Chief execs of our tier one contractors. So, you know, you're on the phone trying to work out everybody's voices and you had to say before who you were. And said, right, we've got an option here. Do you want to stay open or are you going to shut? I thought everyone would say, keep us open. Actually, it wasn't quite that cut and dry, but majority did. And we got to the first 10 and 8 of them had said, please keep us open. One, we can't stop some things, tunnel boring machines. We keep the lights on. We're keeping the power going. But two, we just can't as an industry. The couple that had said they were a bit uncomfortable with continuing, but overall I stopped after 10 and said, right, we're going to keep you open. Okay, but you are going to have to do certain things. I don't know what they are yet, but I'm going to come to you and say, you have to do this. And guys, you're going to have to do it. And they all said, we're in. So we went back to a senior advisor within government and I said, construction's staying open. Okay, we keep the lights on. There was a vague talk about listing out safety critical work. You can't do that for construction. It's too integral. We're going to stay open and we are going to work to some site operating procedures, which I think was a name I made up on the hoof. They use them in the airline industry. Everything's under operating procedures, safe operating or site operating.
But the government must have been delighted that you took that decision away from them or made the decision for them.
I think you are right, because what they actually did then, he actually said, will everybody do it? I literally crossed everything. I didn't have to look him in the eyes because we weren't on screen. And I said, yes, they will. Part of me knowing that if this was industry survival, that they would broadly, and I'm not saying everybody did, but they would broadly, because also the focus would be on us. When everybody else was at home, you would see construction, and that's when they saw us on the public transport, which is where that nearly got shut down. So you're absolutely right. What they actually did then, we kind of led the way, because government, if you remember, started producing guidance, but it was behind us. They were too slow for us. We were changing on a weekly basis because things were changing, distances changing. People were having to work out how to carry a piece of plasterboard with two people. They were having to work out how you could do work in close environments. Oh, my goodness. At one point, I thought, you know, my eyes were going to fall out. The amount of reading, but also the long conversations into the night about what was practical and what complied and what was going to keep people safe. We'd got that whole triangle of ultimately we did not want to expose anybody to risk. So how did we do that safely in a way that was practical and we could do stuff? I mean, interestingly, the industry became much more productive and much more efficient during that time. But we were also able to go back and inform government on what we needed to do that. But they pretty much left construction alone because we demonstrated collectively we were going to work together. We had clear leadership. The Construction Leadership Council met every day. We led on the site operating procedures. Other people led on other bits. So we all played to our strengths and the whole industry stepped up and motored forward. So the one that sticks in my mind is we were one of the first to roll out the testing because we've got big groups of people going to work. And we were also one of the first sectors that rolled out vaccinations, because we could bring in the government advisor on whatever the topic was to all of our companies, the specialists, the trade bodies and the tier one contractors and the clients. We could bring them all in together, hear direct what the ask was. It was about persuading your people to be vaccinated. So we would say, right, we will host a vaccination site on our construction site or around the corner and we'll give them time off to go. It'll become a whole kind of process. So we led the way in a lot of that. One of the other ones that sticks in my mind is there were problems with keeping to programme and outputs. Whilst people were more productive, there were still restricted working hours because you could only have... I had a lot of conversations about how many people get in a lift. I remember that as well. And particularly on some of the towers in London. But people were saying, we can't deliver, we can't do this. And actually, again, we quite listening to it all, we went... Right, so what you actually need is longer site hours. You need more working time. Everyone went, yes, that's what we need. Right, so it's a whole new world for us. Found out the quickest way to do that was a written ministerial statement. Right, okay, so I'm off Googling. What's one of those? Never come across that before. We then wrote the written ministerial statement, submitted it, got it approved, and off the back of that, we could then unleash the industry to do it. But again, it was then, but guys, you've now got to do it responsibly. If you're working in an environment, everybody else is now at home, so don't take the mickey. So structure your deliveries, structure your noisy work, but you can now work longer hours because you're restricted often by local authorities. I could quote it at the time, I couldn't know. That then made its way into legislation, but that process was slower. So by getting the written ministerial statement, we were able to make it happen literally within a week. So they asked for it the 1 week and we went back the next meeting and said, you know, you asked for it, guys. Right, you've now got it. This is what you have to do. We had loads of those. Face coverings was one of those. There's some very specific construction guidance on face coverings. But I think that came about a year after the first lockdown because there was so much controversy over it. And we all ended up wearing them anyway, which I thought we would.
I don't remember any controversy about face coverings. What was the problem with that? I thought everybody just wore a mask. No?
That took about a year to come in because there was the whole, does it work? Is it more dangerous? Are you keeping your own germs, making your own? They weren't available, if you remember. Everybody was donating them to the NHS so you couldn't get them. Do you not remember the shortage of hand sanitizer? My daughter, when she was younger, had a whole, there was a whole phase for collecting those little American hand sanitizers, which became a bit of a craze for teenagers. We were stacked out for hand sanitizers. We just plundered her collection, much to her disgust. But face coverings, there was real controversy, particularly amongst some particular health and safety specialists in the construction sector.
Oh, well, yeah, I never realised that. I never realised that. I mean, I do remember...
I could talk for days about all the things that came up that you've never even thought about.
Well, one thing which came as a real surprise to me was on a big site, on an unfinished building, there'd be a one-way system. There would be only one way through an unfinished building. You couldn't turn around and go back. You had to carry
like
on.
IKEA. It was
like going to IKEA. Yeah, exactly.
And how
do you organise a construction site like that?
And that's where our members, the whole industry, were amazing. What that really did for us as Build UK is everybody suddenly realised the power of collaboration. Before that, there was very little sharing. People did their own thing. They would take a policy and they would adjust it to suit them. They couldn't do that with the site operating procedures. One, because everyone was working at pace and there was so much to think about, they didn't almost have the brain space to do that. But also, they'd be changing so quickly, there was no point in them adding their own little bit onto it because the next day... So they would be sharing photos. People would come on calls and say, oh, my goodness, we've just done this. You probably don't remember. I remember, and I keep getting tingles all over me talking about this, some photos of construction workers in the canteen sitting on their own in a table.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
you're
I remember
only allowed
seeing that.
To sit one at a time. You ask, Philip, another one. You asked about how we made some of these decisions. Some of it, there was clear government policy. Some of it, there was experience from members who'd done something that we were able to adopt and whatnot. I remember sitting with my colleague, my deputy Joe, where, if you remember, they shut down all restaurants or anything serving food. And somebody said, well, what about site canteens? And we sat there, there's no rule, there's nobody to ask, it's coming in tomorrow. So we actually went out of everything. If it keeps our industry working, they're shutting restaurants, they're shutting all food things, we need to follow that suit. That's the closest to a rule that we've got. There's really reasons behind it. Right, people just have to bring lunch in. And so we shut canteens just based on the information we've got, what was right time. And then over time, we then, with our members, worked out, if you remember, they started to open up takeaways, we then worked out what might work. And then that's when you had, you know, only pre-wrapped food was served, no cooked food. That was one of the other one. Oh my goodness, this takes me back, it's like walking down memory lane. We had a site for open doors, I mentioned that, which showed you which construction sites you could go and visit across the country. We started to get calls from particularly civil engineers whose people work away from home and no hotels were open. If you remember, all hotels had shut. So we joined up. I've got a colleague who runs UK Hospitality who deals with hotels and restaurants and things like that. So I had a quick call with her and they had some hoteliers who were willing to open up with their own version of procedures in place if they could get the volume. So what we were able to do is we overnight repurposed our Open Doors website to identify hotels near construction projects that were open that construction workers could use. And they would provide accommodation, safe accommodation. They would also do things like breakfast, because, again, you can't prepare your own sandwiches if you're away from home. And there's no site canteen. So the hotels did all of that. So the little pictures on our Open Doors website were of construction sites. One of my team, I said, just change the picture. And it had like little towels, like a spa towels as the little pictures. And we were like, right, well, just run with that. But what it meant is, again, we could take the pressure off contractors who had lots of things to do by providing them with an easy, really easy way of keeping their workers local to the projects and safe and fed. And we supported another sector. And we still occasionally get messages from hoteliers who said, you helped us as well. And we were kind of, well, you helped us as well. But that was something else that we did, again, literally overnight.
Well, in a way, it seems like the pandemic was Build UK's finest moment. You certainly...
There's a lot of people's finest moment, I think.
Not Boris Johnson's.
Well...
I'm not going to comment on that. You're right, David. But it was we set up in 2015, so when the pandemic came along, we'd had some practice at doing things. We knew people. People were starting to trust us. We were growing as an organisation. So we were positioned to be able to do it. And I like to think that we stepped up and did it. And I'm not saying we got everything right. We learnt a lot. There is a way, you've just got to find it. And we had lots of conversations with NHS England, government departments I'd never even heard of and never spoken to, about some very detailed technical issues, transfer of things and types of face coverings and all that kind of stuff. But everybody wanted to find a way to do it.
Yeah.
And we did, pretty much.
Yeah. I hate to change the subject because, I'd like to hear you talk about this for another 2 hours just on how the industry responded to COVID, because it's absolutely fascinating. It's important. I mean, did you give evidence to the COVID inquiry? Did the COVID inquiry ask for any input from industries?
They didn't. It's quite interesting. When that came up, I thought, oh, my goodness, they are going to come our way. Well, we submitted some evidence in terms of what the industry
and
did. They would be looking
at... I mean, a big part of the question mark about the inquiry is it became a sort of a witch hunt rather than a lessons learnt. And I'm thinking there are lessons that they can learn from the construction industry, but they didn't. They didn't come asking lessons from you.
No. Not particularly. They didn't know.
Well, they should have. They're stupid. Mm. But then it wouldn't have occurred until hearing what you've just been saying for the past 20 minutes or whatever. I would like to talk a lot more about this, but I know we haven't got you for long, and I've got more questions, particularly about, you mentioned some of your achievements. What are the issues which have been proved frustrations where perhaps haven't been solved? And I'm sure... I hope you're going to mention retentions on this topic.
What hasn't? There's always more to do on lots of things. The industry is really good at saying what it wants to do and wants to change. Actually shifting that dial, and because everybody has to do something different. And often people think that somebody else needs to do something different. What they're doing is fine. It's everybody else who needs to change. I think that's a bit of human nature. So things like even the common assessment standard, that was one of our first pieces of work. The first meeting was actually a couple of weeks before we officially launched as Build UK. And we've made huge progress on that. But we still every day have to, I call it holding the water uphill. You've got to keep on it. And again, that's what's different about Build UK. We don't just write a report and say, this is what you should do. We then put in place the systems that enable everybody to play their part, but then you've got to keep everybody moving on track. So the Common Assessment Standard, for example, government has now adopted it. It's in the construction playbook. It meets the requirements of demonstrating organisational capability for building safety. But we are ensuring that more and more people are using it, so it becomes the way of demonstrating organisational capability. You mentioned their retentions. Payment is still a challenge. I don't think payment is just a construction issue. I think it's a power imbalance through any supply chain. So it's not just a construction issue, but it is particularly pertinent. You know, 99% of companies in construction are SMEs and work tier 2, tier 3, tier 4 down the chain. So they have to wait for the cash to flow all the way down. I mentioned our benchmarking of payment performance, and we did that following the introduction of the duty to report. So we don't have to go and get the data. Businesses are rubbish at filling in surveys. So anything that requires a survey to find the answer is never going to give you the answer, because we never get, we never really get sufficient number of responses for you to start making policy decisions.
I guess this is why you don't, as far as I know, you don't publish state of trade surveys, which I'm often suspicious of, because as you say, when people get a form, there's, tick, 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 without really looking at it. And therefore, some state of trade reports from some trade associations can be really quite, quite vague. A net balance of 17% of our members are happy today.
And we stopped it for that reason, because we were kind of, it was really time consuming. We did it all and we were reviewing everything. I was like, how many people respond to this? And it wasn't quite, three people in a small spaniel, but it wasn't in a way. And actually, if you look at other organisations, do it much better. Commercial organisations do it better. So in the nicest possible way, it's not our forte. So on terms of payment, we work with the government on their duty to report. So companies over a certain size have to submit their payment data against certain metrics. So that's on a website. So we said to our members back in 2018, right, OK, we're going to put this in a table. a league table. And everyone's like, oh, we love a league table. Well, they do. You love a league table when you're at the top of it. Nobody likes a league table when you're at the bottom of it. I've noticed that. So, that was really interesting. We lost members over it. We had...
Who? Name names.
One... No, I'm not going to name names. You know I'm not going to name names.
Alphabeti?
That was quick, though. You were quick in there.
Is that Alphabeti or Murphy?
I'm not naming any names.
Costain?
And somebody said, well, you know, I don't want you to do this. Why are you doing this? And my answer was, well, for one, it's an issue. Two, transparency works. And three, if we don't do it, somebody else will do it. Right?
That's true.
And if we do it, what we were able to do when we very first did it, because it was new for everybody, they had to change accounting systems, everything. The very first time, my colleague Jo led on this, and she is just absolutely awesome in how she, it is her who has shifted the dial on this, is we said to our members, if you give us your data early, we will mock up the benchmarking table. We can then show you where you are. You won't be able to change it because it's on your last 6 months of performance, but you will know where you are. So if you are towards the bottom of that table, you will know in advance. So you can talk to your board, you can talk to your clients, you can talk to your supply chain, and you can decide what your position is going to be. How are you going to respond? Which is a much better way than the first time you see it is on the front of a construction press and you're bottom of the league table and they're singling you out. So once we presented it in that way, the majority of people went, oh, right, yeah, okay. So we got from the majority of people, and we also said, you'll only get that mocked up table if you submit your data. So if you don't want to give us your data, absolutely fine. That is a decision for you. And I'm always like that. My job isn't to tell you how to run your business. You are much better at that than me. But if you don't give us your data, you won't see where you are in the table. So it will be up to you to manage your comms. So, and we were also able to handhold and support our members in what the requirements were. They're quite complicated. You have to do quite a bit of maths in making sure that, you know, often people say, well, they're fudging the figures. Well, they might be, but their FD signs it when they submit it. And their name is on the government website of the individual, the named individual who have submitted those figures. So you're a very brave individual, because at any point the Cabinet Office could come and say, we'd like to explore this because we've got complaints that you're not performing in accordance with this payment and we'd like to unpick this. And by the way, you signed it. So I think it's a pretty big responsibility. Yeah. It's as far as we could go. In terms of retentions, you're absolutely right, Philip. It is a tricky issue. I think there is clear agreement now, and this is where we shifted the dial with our Tier 1 contractors. They moved from not even talking about it to having grown-up conversations about it and recognising that, do you know what, it isn't the way to do business. We do it because of these reasons, but we know it doesn't drive the right behaviour. We're kind of stuck in this. We have it withheld from clients. We withheld it. We don't quite know what else to do. And I had we had a lunch with some of our Tier 1 contractors and some specialists, and I had a big Tier 1 contractor, and I will name on this, this is Mark Reynolds from Mace. He was Chief Executive of Mace at the time, and we had some of our specialist contractors, and one of our larger specialist contractors looked at Mark and said, I've worked for you for years, I've always delivered a cracking job, and if there are any other issues, I will come back and fix them for you, and I've proved that. It isn't fair that you withhold a retention from me in the same way you withhold it from all your other suppliers who don't have that same relationship. And Mark turned round and went, I get it. And that's the first time I've truly, it's not fair. Forget all the other reasons. It's not fair. And that was a bit of a turning point. And that's what you need. You need sometimes those conversations where somebody in a leadership role who can make things happen just kind of does right in front of your eyes a, I get it, because you've got two individuals talking to each other. And that was a bit of a turning point. So the Construction Leadership Council has been very clear on it, is looking for a solution to retentions. We don't have one yet, because this is one that the industry has to sort itself out. I cannot see any government coming in and writing legislation for something if there is going to be a backlash from a sector. It's no politician is going to do that. But let me tell you the steps that are in place. We have a roadmap. It did get a bit kiboshed by COVID because that took about 3 years out of literally doing anything other than COVID. But we've set out minimum standards for retentions. We've written the contractual clauses, and I now have specialists who say, by Jove, this works. I go in with these minimum standards and match them up against my contracts, and most contractors I ask will now implement those standards because I know what I'm talking about and I'm very specific about what I'm asking. I'm just not saying no retention. I've got the contractual clause, I've got why, and I've got what I need you to do differently. So you're starting to meet in the middle. The metrics on payment, you also now, from now, July, I think it's 1st of July, you have to start reporting the retentions you've got withheld from you in value and the retentions you're withholding. So we've just updated our table. The metrics won't come from everybody just yet because you report 6 months after your financial year starts. So it kind of, the big chunk I think will be January and July. Everybody who reports will have to report what they've got withheld and what they're withholding.
And you're going to put that on your late payment table?
Yep.
Oh, wow. Excellent. When are you going to start doing that? 6 months' time?
When they start to report. So we have just updated our table. Oh, God, which requires a whole revamp of a website for a table. But we'll end up with a nice website at the end of it with much easier to navigate all the fantastic stuff we do. But that will be on the report. But, Philip, you have to bear in mind that for many companies, their first reporting may not be for 9 to 6 months.
Yeah.
Because you report, but it'll be here before you know it. You know, everybody said, oh, you've got to wait 6 months. It'll be here before you know it. And you end up, you do a little bit of maths because you end up with a number which shows whether you've got more retention withheld from you than you are withholding. So you'll start to see where the money sticks. And the clients will have to do this. The contractors will have to. Anybody who reports will have to do that. So, you know, for example, I think you'll start to see that professional services in the industry aren't subject to retentions.
No, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, many in the supply chain are.
Yeah.
You'll see who's withholding them. So a bit like when we did the payment table, it was really interesting. Transparency is key. I'm an engineer. I'm quite direct. You kind of get what you see. If you hold up something and somebody said to me, where do you get these figures from? Well, your FD submitted them. I haven't done anything. They are your figures. I've literally picked them off the bit of paper that you gave. That opened a few eyes. Because I think people in a leadership role often believe they're doing the right thing. They believe they've given them messages to do the right thing. But there are other drivers within the organisation. If you tell a department in your company that they've got to pay their supply chain, but at the same time they've got to have £1 million cash in the bank, those two aren't always compatible. So if you're sitting there with somebody going, well, I've got to pay everybody, but if I pay everybody, I don't meet the other target, they are going to start making decisions. And I would imagine they're going to make the decision to keep £1 million in the bank because that probably feels to them more important. So transparency starts to flush out things. What it also flushed out, there was a massive jump, improvement in the payment terms, a couple of years ago. And the reason being is most people's payment systems weren't great. So their intention was to pay, their commitment was to pay, but by the time an invoice had come from site to the office to the payment department, and it was missing a full stop and somebody's inside leg measurement, so it went back for that, they'd missed their payment targets. And so I'm a systems girl, what just by benchmarking it, you didn't just automatically improve payment terms. What it does is unravel what you need to do differently to change that. And that's not always easy. So you asked a question earlier, why does it take so long? Because fundamental shift, fundamental change isn't easy. It really
no, you can't
isn't.
Do it overnight. And you can't get everybody to do it at the same time either.
Exactly. Yeah. And once you know that, actually, you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to get, you've got to start on that journey. You've got to start something. And I talk about, people always want a big cog shifting. We want no retentions, which is the massive cog. But to do that, you've got lots of smaller cogs you have to turn in order to shift that big cog. And too many people, in my personal opinion, want the big cog or nothing. You've got to work out what turns the small cogs to turn the big cog, because that starts turning sometimes if you hit the right things at the bottom. And that's what we're always trying to work out. We talk about in within the Build UK team, what makes the boat go faster? What makes the boat go faster? Which of these five things that you want me to do is going to make the biggest difference in the industry? Some might be a really quick win and sound fantastic, but they don't shift the dial. Somebody else can do that. I'm interested in the stuff that's too difficult for a lot of people that will shift the dial and give us a much better, more productive, more financially viable industry in the longer term.
Can I ask my final question? Back to the issue of industry representation, lobbying, interaction with government. Are you personally on the Construction Leadership Council?
I am, yes.
I thought you might be. So you will sit down with ministers at that forum. Do you? But sometimes you'll sit down, I guess, as Build UK, you have access to government. And I'm intrigued at what point you look to the Construction Leadership Council, which is not representative, it's hand-picked people appointed by government, administered by government, with no democracy, no mandate, no legitimacy, and Build UK, which is the democratic organisation representing its members, and has much more natural authority, but perhaps less power and kudos somehow. How do you play those two avenues?
It's a team game. So whatever you think of the Construction Leadership Council, it brings that top level of industry representation together and it makes a difference. And again, we learned that during COVID. We could have done a lot during COVID, but by bringing the tier one contractors together, the supply chain together, and Build UK through our membership, with the construction products, with the consultants, with the Federation of Master Builders, with the merchants, we're like an industry superpower. So the challenge is the CLC doesn't have any resources as such. It relies on a super little team within department for business. But the collective weight of all of us is much more powerful. So we're also much smarter. I don't need to go in and say, oh, I've met the minister this week. Clearly it's quite nice to do that, but I don't need to go in and say, I've met the minister this week. If it's a products issue, I am much better when they invite me to the meeting to say, OK, I can come, but really you need the Construction Products Association there because they are the lead on products. I can play to my skill set. I can bring my strengths to it. But there is somebody better placed to do that. And I think that's also the difference about Build UK. I don't have to lead on everything. The Construction Leadership Council brings together the right organisations to play to our strengths. Now, we do play a leading role because the part of the industry, we're the largest in terms of membership, not necessarily the largest in terms of organisation, but largest in terms of membership. We have interesting times with things like the competition and mergers authority because we have a dominant position in the market because we represent so many of the industry. But we're not always the right body to lead on everything. Building safety. We haven't talked about building safety. We've got about 5 minutes left. That's a whole other podcast. You're interested in COVID, building safety is even more interesting.
Can we get you back for that one?
We are shifting the dial. I'd be delighted to come back. We are shifting the dial on building safety. We've done a huge amount as Build UK because it directly affects all of our members in the supply chain. But Mark Reynolds, as chair of the Construction Leadership Council, has played a huge part because he's at that sharp ending with ministers bringing in the right people. So I think last week, you know, we were at a ministerial roundtable on building safety. We were in with the Treasury and Darren Jones on the pipeline. And I was in somewhere else. Oh, in the Department for Business with the Permanent Secretary, talking about different things. So I think it's not a competition. There is no competition here. It is about how we get the loudest, strongest voice for construction And you've seen that in the way government has responded. Build UK, we have played a huge part in that, and I wouldn't undervalue or underestimate that. But we are part of a bigger team construction, and that is where the real value lies. And on building safety, you see people like Cole Whiteman, who is from an individual business, Barclay, the Barclay Group. He has stepped up and played a massive leading role because he can talk about it personally and passionately. We've provided a whole team of people behind him so that he can talk on behalf of the industry, but he was absolutely the right person to lead on that. So it's a team game. Hmm. It's not a competition.
Have we come to a natural conclusion? It sounded like a good sign off that. What, have you got any more questions, Phil?
I think end of part one, I hope.
I think, yeah, exactly.
I would love to come back and talk about building safety.
Yep. Mm.
I think that is a game changer for the industry. We're in the really, really painful part right now, but again, only by working together we will come out the other side. Competence, the skill level, the people that we have in our industry are just 3 million of them work in our great industry. Mm. One in every 10 people work in the working population. One in every 10 school leavers we need to come into our industry to keep that workforce afloat. So industry card schemes, how we're actually raising the game, how we, and I personally am passionate about apprentices and how we bring that next generation. Construction's been good for me. I've had the most amazing career. I hope it's not over just yet. I've still got some things I'd like to do. I'd love to come back and continue the conversation if that would be of interest.
Absolutely. We'll get our people to talk to your people.
As they say. You sound very important. You sound very important when you say that, Phil.
I am my people.
Yeah, excellent.
Thank you very much.
Well, look, shall we tie it up then?
I think so.
We've been talking for a long time now.
An hour, I think.
I know. Yeah. We have. Phil, do you want to do
the outro, don't I?
Spiel.
I think it's probably, we've been doing this podcast for, well, since COVID, since, when did we do our first one of these? This is certainly
2020.
This is our certainly longest. 2020, this is our 182nd podcast, and we've never managed to keep talking for quite so long. And I want to keep going for longer because, as we just discussed there, Susanna Nicol, what she's been doing at Build UK, has got lots to talk about, knows lots, got massive of inside scoop and all sorts of things, which we will try and dig out of her next time. But she will be back. We'll work it out. But for another episode of Reconstruction, thank you, everyone, for listening. Goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.